This podcast was recorded at 9 a.m. 1 March, Jakarta time. Things may have changed by the time you listen to this podcast. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back to Reformasi Dispatch. I'm Jeff Hutton.
And I am Kevin O'Rourke.
Well, we've got a great episode, and we're going to change things around a little bit. Like normally, we do about half-hour banter here, back and forth on the news. But I'm going to turn the episode on its head. We're going to speak with Iko Prasojo. He was the Deputy Minister of Administrative and Bureaucratic Reform in the second term of SBY. And currently, he is still advising on bureaucratic reform for Vice President Maruf Amin. And we're going to run through a bit of news. Before we do that, we're going to look at some polls that show Prabowo in the lead, some very first meaty polls that came out in the past year. But the question is whether those numbers are yeasty, whether they've got further to rise. A D&I list that hopefully says good things about podcasting companies. Falling positivity rates. It is on. I noticed here in the apartment complex in Jakarta, they've got tents out front where they've started vaccinating people over 60. So it's really something that's to see the vaccination effort in the up close and personal. But first, there is some news out of South Sulawesi you want to touch on first before we get going.
Right. Yeah. So this is a developing story, and maybe things will have changed. But the governor there, Noordin Abdullah, appears to have entered custody with the Independent Anti-Corruption Commission, although his sources are claiming that he was merely brought in for questioning. However, he was woken up in the middle of the night at his home in Makassar and flown to Jakarta immediately for questioning. So it looks like an arrest. And this is a shocker because he has stood out as one of Indonesia's cleanest figures and most promising future leaders. So it's either a very disappointing fall from grace for him. He was Indonesia's only professor elected to a provincial governor post when he won election for the first time in 2018. He's in his first term. Or it's a terrible scandal and a miscarriage of justice. And so the judgment needs to be reserved for now, of course, but it's a kind of a dramatic and scary story. So he was not one of the leaders among the up-and-coming regional heads, simply because his province is not quite the among the top tier. His province is the seventh largest by population, so it doesn't compare with the ones on Java. But he was definitely the leader of that next tier among provincial governors.
What's he accused of doing?
They reportedly discovered 1 billion rupiah in cash, but in a separate location, not in his home. So this was not what they call a red-handed arrest, which goes by the acronym OTT in Bahasa Indonesia. This was not that. That's why there's still potential for the perceptions to change on this.
And he was an up-and-coming figure, but was he on track for a presidential run, do you think, or he was not quite of that caliber?
He might have had an outside shot in 2024, but maybe longer term, he certainly was on a trajectory to get a cabinet post someday. He's in his early 50s, and he had served 10 years as a very reformist, highly acclaimed chief of Banteng District in South Sulawesi. He's trained in Japan as an agronomist, I think, and had a lot of reformist ideas and credentials. So, yeah, he was definitely up and coming. Mm-hmm.
I guess if you were looking to balance out a ticket, if you had even the remotest inkling of wanting some regional balance, South Sulawesi is a good bet, a la Joseph Kalla, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And his election in 2018 was one of the highlights of that election cycle for regional heads, especially because he beat out some really formidable, entrenched sort of venal figures from the local elite. And voters opted for him based on his record of reform and clean governance in Banteng. So,
okay, well, watch this space. Okay, moving on to the 2024 polls. The first set of meaty polls, the ones that have in-person interviews, not just telephone polls, but in-person interviews that catch a wider swath of the population, came out last week, and they show Prabowo with a sizable lead. But you wonder if maybe he could be at a ceiling. There isn't much room for him to grow. And Ganja Pranowo, the governor of Central Java, is the dark horse.
That's right. Yeah. So this is exciting because it's a poll from a highly credible, could say venerable firm. It's a survey institute, Lembaga Survei Indonesia. And for the first time now in a year, this is a poll using face-to-face interviews. How they pulled this off, I don't know. Obviously, wearing masks and I guess going through interview questions at a distance from respondents. But the polling took place in the fourth week of January. So it's at the time, case transmissions were high. So it's kind of surprising to see this, but face-to-face interviews produce much better results with much better accuracy than the alternative over the past year, which has been polls using cell phones.
Yeah. There's been some doubt in the U.S. as to the accuracy of polls. How do Indonesian pollsters do?
Well, when they're face-to-face polls, they do extremely well. That's precisely the problem in the U.S. is that in the U.S. there's a need to use phones one way or another. And so these cell phone polls that have been taking place over the past year have shown some different results. So that's apparent now. Basically, other polls from good firms that have had to rely on cell phone contact data over the past year showed Prabowo and Ganjar head-to-head. This new poll from the Survey Institute using face-to-face interviews shows Prabowo out in front by double digits, about 11 percentage points or so. So there's a question with 10 names on the list for respondents to choose from, and Prabowo scored 26% of respondents in that list as the preferred presidential candidate, and Ganjar was a solid second place, but with only 15%.
Why do you wonder if Prabowo is going to struggle to get much higher?
His name recognition is already universal. He's a household name, having run for president twice and vice president once, whereas Ganjar is still not well known, especially outside his home province. Also, Prabowo has burned his bridges with a group that was one of his core constituencies in the last two elections, which is more strident Islamic-oriented voters. They regard his decision a year and a half ago to join the Widodo administration as defense minister as a betrayal.
Interestingly, in the poll, there's some cross tabs, and Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono's son. And Agus. We're going to have to do some Agus. So Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono's son, Agus, isn't doing so well. I thought this is interesting.
Yeah.
Third place in his father's party. We want to do a little riff on that.
Right. Yeah. And it's not just him, but also Puan Maharani, the daughter PDIP chair Megawati. What's interesting is that respondents don't really appreciate either of these offspring of former presidents. So there's really a clear preference for regional heads who have executive experience, because other figures with substantial support are Ridwan Kamil of West Java. He ranks fifth in the poll. Anies Baswedan of Jakarta, who ranks third. Also Kofifa Indar Parawansa, the governor of East Java. Also in the top 10. And then the other figure mixed in there is Sandiago Uno, the now tourism minister, but he had been the running mate of Prabowo in 2019.
And for about 10 minutes, he was vice governor of Jakarta.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
for about a week.
About half a year, I think. Yeah, not long.
Not why should we be looking at polls now, though? We got a little while to go before 2020.
Yeah, well, this is kind of when candidates are positioning themselves and lining up and gaining momentum or squandering momentum. So this is actually a pretty important stage. So the election will be in the first half of 2024, but the nominations will be taking place in probably the third quarter of 2023. And that's just a little over 2 years away. So it's kind of a critical juncture to start looking at the polls, actually. So I think the key thing for Ganjar is that he'll have a chance to boost his name recognition and profile, especially because nobody has been promoting him yet or endorsing him, and not even his own party, because Megawati has been on the fence. Yeah, he belongs to PDIP. So assuming that will happen, then that'll provide him with a big boost. PDIP has a big support base, and these crosstabs in the poll that you mentioned show that I think a lot of PDIP followers are not really up to speed on Ganjar yet. So that'll provide him a boost down the road, and should help him catch up to Prabowo, I would think.
How would you go about getting the name recognition out there? Because up until a year ago, I didn't know who Ganjar Pranowo was. That's not a barometer for anything. But I'm guessing that, you know, outside of Central Java, he's sort of an unknown quantity. So how do you get the name recognition out there?
And this is a double-edged sword, because Ganjar's lack of name recognition is not for lack of trying, because he really does try hard. Yeah, he's never met a publicity stunt that he doesn't like, I would say. I guess that served him fairly well, because he is a solid second place. But you know, I think these polls that are going to be coming out are going to be generating name recognition. I think there's going to be an increased awareness that he is probably the person best positioned to potentially beat Prabowo. And so you'll see people gradually coalescing behind him, probably.
Okay, moving on. Do not invest list. Usually this is sort of Peter taking from Paul or something. It's like the government would, I forget how that metaphor goes, or the simile goes. The government would ease up restrictions on one sector but clamp down on another. This looks like a wholesale sort of easing up on foreign investment and a big chunk of the economy.
Yeah, this is really a dramatic breakthrough for economic reform, actually, because foreign inflows of capital are crucial for Indonesia's economic growth, especially at a time in recent years when its current account deficit has been so problematic. And now, especially in an attempt to pull out of the pandemic, the crucial need to employ people, and that's going to require job creation, especially in manufacturing, which is going to require foreign investment. So all of a sudden now, the negative investment list, the list of sectors that are closed or only conditionally open to foreigners, basically foreign ownership ceilings in percentage terms, is virtually gone now. It's pretty much every sector is available to 100% full foreign ownership now. But there's a few caveats.
Hmm.
One is that in some cases, the sectors have been moved to an expanded list of sectors that are reserved only for small and medium enterprises and cooperatives, or known as UMKM. Sorry, UKMK.
Yeah.
So those small companies are called UKMK. And then other sectors are moved to a list which requires partnerships with UKMK. So that's one caveat. Another caveat is that there's other regulations elsewhere that restrict participation in certain sectors. So it doesn't mean that it's going to be a free-for-all everywhere overnight. There's still going to be other restrictions on foreign investment. But this nonetheless is dramatic. There's really only just a handful of sectors that are still closed to majority foreign ownership. And those are mainly around land-based transportation and ferry services, inter-island especially. But meanwhile, there's some things that are opened up that were not even expected, especially alcohol business, specifically within four provinces that are majority non-Muslim. That's Bali, North Sulawesi, Papua, and East Nusa Tenggara, NTT. So that's a big change and could boost tourism.
Not big Muslim, big Muslim enclaves.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how it's reserved for that. There's still questions around the distribution, but still, that's a bold change. In fact, if anything, you know, this list is arguably too bold because it apparently, from how I read it, completely lifts restrictions that had prohibited all foreign ownership in two key natural resources sectors, which is logging in natural forests and fishing in territorial waters. So I don't think that those sectors are really truly going to be wide open to foreign ownership now, especially logging. There'll be other restrictions put in place elsewhere by the line ministries in those sectors. But nonetheless, it is a little bit disconcerting to see those particular sectors opened up so dramatically like that. This is all, of course, taking place in the backdrop of the potential for or the reality of rapid growth of Chinese investment in recent years.
Right, exactly. The activity may be coming from countries that are not, shall we say, environmentally conscious or have terribly good reporting standards.
Yeah, the reporting standards and the governance as well. That's right. So will increased ease of investment, ironically, actually bring about more kickbacks and rent-seeking behavior that infects and compromises legal certainty as a result of the wrong types of investors coming in.
And finally, in our chat before we move on to the interview with Papa Echo, falling positivity rates. We're down to about 16%. Is Indonesia turning a corner? I just noticed out front there's a vaccination center in my apartment complex.
Yeah, this really is a dramatic race now. It's a race to get the vaccinations into the arms before the new variants arrive and trigger another spike. And compared to where Indonesia was just a mere short 1 month ago, circumstances have definitely improved. One of the key indicators is the bed occupancy rate, because that's one that is actually quite feasible to measure, and it's a strong indicator of the hospitalizations. And that has definitely declined everywhere. It's really only in Jakarta that it's still just barely above 70%. There's a handful of other provinces where it ranges between 55 and 70%. And most elsewhere in the country, it's below 55%. And the problem has always been testing, but just last week, that suddenly soared by 90% for some unexplained reason. But meanwhile, you know, daily confirmations of new cases remained flat.
Why would that be? Why would it nearly double? They get a consignment of reagents or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the government's communications on this aspect of the pandemic have been really poor. I don't think anybody would reasonably fault them for problems that are affecting either the testing or the reporting of testing. But nonetheless, the government is not disclosing the reasons for the apparently exceedingly low testing levels and the exceedingly high positivity rates earlier during the month of February, when sometimes they actually topped 40%, which is just an outlandish positivity rate. So the question is that a lot of labs may not have been reporting the negative results. The labs are stressed, they're overworked, they're busy, the personnel are tired. And so when they get a positive result, they report that. If they get a negative result, they don't report it. That may have been happening. We don't know. Stands to reason, it would make sense. It would help explain some of the trends that have happened. But another possibility is simply shortages of materials for the PCR tests or shortages of workers. Whatever it is, the government really ought to explain it, because it would help erase some of the uncertainty and apprehensions that result in a vacuum of clear information.
Right. It almost strikes me as an own goal and sadly plausible. But okay, well, watch this space as well. Now, before we move on to the interview, can you help set up for us who Echo Prasojo is and why you're at me and at me and at me? It just would not stop. You wanted to talk to this guy?
This Professor Echo Prasojo, everybody already knows. He's the bureaucratic reform guy. Come on.
Yeah. My little niece follows him on Instagram.
So, yeah, a long time ago, I latched on to bureaucratic reform as something that Indonesia would really benefit from. And so I went out and hunted down the experts on the topic, and all of them told me Ecto Prasojo is the person to talk to. So he's the expert's expert. And he's actually literally the chair of the National Bureaucratic Reform Implementing Team that reports to Vice President Maruf Amin now. And he's the dean of the Faculty of Public Administration at the University of Indonesia. And he had served as the vice minister for state apparatus empowerment and bureaucratic reform in the second Yudhoyono administration a decade ago.
So do we have him to thank for the fact that I've got friends here who say they don't need to bring in a couple hundred thousand rupiah when they want to redo their KTP or their driver's license? They don't have to bribe the person on the other side anymore. This is done online and it's all tickety-boo within a few days. Or right there, maybe.
Absolutely. I think so. Yeah. So in our interview with Professor Ecko, it's interesting to touch on all these topics because what he's been doing over the years has been tackling endless details here and there simply because there has not been a real concerted high-level political push for profound fundamental bureaucratic reform. So instead, it's been a lot of tinkering. It pays off to an extent. So there's been a lot of improvements. It's a very multifaceted issue. So there's a lot of places to nibble away at the problem. Recruitment, training, promotions, job selection, posting, and then especially the big problem of remuneration and performance incentives. And then also things like pensions, and then the actual organizational structure of the bureaucracy itself. All these things need a lot of work.
And I think the big question that you had for him was whether or not the government was going to back, I think, is it an opposition bill to remove the overseeing body of bureaucratic reform in the local governments, the KASN? I mean, it turns out actually it's the opposite. They want to strengthen it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you follow bureaucratic reform, it's very dramatic. And for other people, maybe it's not so interesting, but...
No, it is. Yeah. No, absolutely. As you're an egghead, but...
Thanks. Yeah. So as you described it, the KASN basically is the watchdog agency to make sure that high-level appointments are merit-based throughout the government, central and regional, actually. And the parties in parliament, turns out, don't like that because Widodo has given away a lot of ministerial portfolios to six or seven parties, and they'd like to be able to put whomever they like into some of the plum postings there. But KASN, the KASN Commission, is the ones that police that and get in the way. So therefore, parliament introduced this bill on its own to basically eradicate KASN. And then suddenly the Widodo administration 2 weeks ago said that it would agree to proceed with deliberations. And that was a worry sign because then there was concern that the government would comply with this intention of the parties to kill the commission. It turns out that Professor Ecko told us in our interview that, in fact, the Home Affairs Minister and especially the Minister of State Apparatus and Bureaucratic Reform, Chayo Kumulo, has made clear that he will defend the commission, KASN. So they're turning it on its head. So instead of this bill coming out to be something that weakens bureaucratic reform, Kumulo and other figures in the government and in parliament too, including the Golkar chair of Commission 2 on Home Affairs, that's Ahmad Dali Kurnia, they're going to actually work to strengthen the 2014 civil service law.
I feel a podcast coming on, a series on the KASN or something like that. And we can do like some merchandise with that too, with all the action figures. Now it should be noted.
Yeah, it's...
it should be noted, audience, that Kevin's admiration for Bappa Ecko is one way. But Bappa Ecko did not know who Kevin was. And kept confusing him with our technical guru Stephen, and Stephen's a pretty smart guy, so
which was our fault. That was our fault because we got on the line and explained to Professor Echo that Stephen is going to have to leave to take a phone call during our interview. And at that time it was Jeff and I talking. And so he heard Jeff and Stephen and Jeff and Stephen. So he thought that I was Stephen.
Yeah. So if there's any confusion, that's it. Anyway, here's Papa Echo. Jeff Hutton, I'm with the Straits Times and a regional correspondent. I'm just sort of as someone who's sort of a newcomer to this, when we're talking about bureaucratic reform, what is it in particular you have in mind that needs to be reformed? Is it the recruitment? Is it the retention? And is there any low-hanging fruit that you think can be addressed in reasonably short order?
That's good question. Actually, if we are talking about bureaucratic reform or administrative reform as a comprehensive concept, we are talking about reforming the human resource management system, including the recruitment system, selections, promotion system, compensation system, performance indicator measurements, and so on. This is what we did actually for the 6 or 7 years, by enacting the civil service law. And we are also talking about the restructuring and also business process re-engineering, in order to get alignment amongst the ministries for planning, budgeting that based on the performance indicators. So making better performance-based planning and budgeting. This is one of the aspects that we are going to improve in the Indonesian bureaucracy. But we are talking also about the cultural reform. Establishing new values for Indonesian bureaucratic, like incorruptibility, meritocracy, focus on public service delivery, and so on.
Yeah, mindset.
Yeah.
When these reforms are introduced, presumably it requires a certain amount of, accountability and the change of mindset. How is it received? There must be a certain amount of opposition. What kind of opposition do you face?
Okay. We're starting actually... the initial step was started in 2003 when we enacted public finance law, where the planning budgeting should be based on the performance indicators. When I was the vice minister, so I established a new model of performance-based planning and budgeting model, so implemented by ministries, national agencies, and also local governments. So we measure the indicator performance of planning in ministries and also in the local governments. It's quite good, I think, the result that the bureaucrat or civil service now they are focusing on the indicator indicator of performance in the planning and also budgeting. But this is not enough because this is about the capability of civil servant to determine what is the performance should be achieved. For example, they have to be understanding about output, outcome, and also impact of the program and also activities. So this is the potential inefficiency that we have already reduced, I think, in 4 or 5 years. That potential inefficiency for planning and budgeting in Indonesia is yearly about 497 trillion rupiah.
Wow.
This is quite big money. And so our reform goals is to reduce the potential inefficiency in a program and activities in the ministries and also in local governments.
Can I just make sure, the 497 trillion rupiah, that's potential efficiency gains per year?
Yes, this is a year. Potential inefficiency, this is potential efficiency, so-called. And we are going to reduce the this potential inefficiency by improving the quality of planning and budgeting. Yeah. Normally, they create a program and activities without any specific and measurable performance indicator. This is a habit of Indonesian civil service, yeah, I think.
Well, these are the meetings at the Four Seasons, the end of year meetings, right? To spend the budget stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. we reduce in 2019 40 trillion rupiah by improving the quality of planning and budgeting. Yeah, and I think in 2017 we reduce also potential inefficiency until 60 trillion rupiah. This is a big money that we can save and reduce in the bureaucratic reform. Yeah.
Pak Eko, thank you for joining us. It's great to have your perspective. Is it because the compensation for civil servants comes not just from their base salary and not even from performance rewards, but rather from other sources like honorarium and per diems and things like that?
This is one of the reasons, yeah, why the program and activities can be reduced because they're using normally program and activities to increase their take home pay, yeah, by having some money from the activities and so on. This is one of the reasons why their take home pay is still high, even the salary is basic salary is low, yeah.
Right. Okay. And here I understand it's important to differentiate between salary on one hand and total take-home pay at the end of the month on the other hand. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the problem of civil service system in Indonesia. Yeah. So they get low salary, but they bring much money take home for his their family actually. So this is what we are going to revise through the government regulations, yeah, but the compensation and also pension system in civil service in Indonesia, yeah.
So if we look at the total take home pay at the end of the month, it's actually quite good relative to other countries.
Yeah, I think so. If we are talking about take home pay, I think this is quite good, yeah, for the civil servant, yeah. So because they have basic salary, they have performance incentive, yeah, bureaucratic performance incentive, and some other incentive for civil servants, yeah, for family incentive, yeah, structural position incentive, and so on, yeah.
I recall Sri Mulyani as finance minister during the Yudhoyono era. Embarked on a program within her ministry to replace all the various honorariums and per diems and other types of stipends with one big remuneration stipend that was key to attaining performance standards or indicators. Has that rolled out elsewhere in the government? Is that a focus?
Yeah, this is also my proposal at the time. So we audited the take-home pay of Echelon 1 and Echelon 2 in the ministries, yeah. So amazing, you know, that they will bring 100 million rupiah as take-home pay, yeah. So that's why I propose that we have to abolish honorarium, yeah, in Indonesia. There is so many honorarium, yeah, activities honorarium, committee honorarium, and so on, so. So in 2014, we released a ministerial decree on reducing honorarium, yeah, I think, because we give the ministries a so-called incentive for bureaucratic reform, yeah, bureaucratic reform incentive, yeah. Where we did get the money actually at that time, because we pushed the ministries and agencies to get efficiency in the program and activities. So with this efficiency, they could also bureaucratic reform incentive. So this is not a new budget in the national budget, but this is result of efficiency that they created by improving the planning budgeting process. Yeah.
So it's like a repackaging and a rationalization.
That's right. This is repackaging of money from honorarium into the performance incentive, performance for bureaucratic reform. Yeah.
Can I just jump in there, though? I mean, somebody must lose when you're repackaging and you're redirecting the money. So who tends to benefit in those cases? And who loses out? I mean, the people that can game the system, presumably those are more senior people who have been around, and suddenly they don't get these honorariums. Who's out and who's in on this?
Yeah, that's good questions. This is incomparable, actually. Yeah, with the honorarium, the Echelon 1 and Echelon 2 in some ministries, yeah, not all ministries, actually, they will bring more than 200 million rupiah or 300 million rupiah. Totally, as take home pay, for basic salary, incentive, honorarium for activities, honorarium for a committee, and so on.
But per year,
per month and also per year. Yeah. Wow. So, I think the person who benefit this program is the ministries with low honorarium activities and also for committee. Yeah. And the loser one is the ministries who have very big money in their honorarium for activities and for committee. I think, this is a winner and also loser in this policy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this process of repackaging and rationalization, for lack of a better term, how has that been rolling out? How has the process been going so far?
I think the performance of bureaucratic slowly improved, institutionally and also personally, by giving them better incentive for bureaucratic reform, Although the number, the amount of money is also still low compared to the private sector, to the another public sector in other countries, But I think, we can say that in 10 years of bureaucratic reform, since 2010, I think the performance of civil servants slowly improved, Even I think this happened only in the national governments, because Indonesia is very decentralized governments. I think in the local government, the condition is still the same. Yeah, but this is our problem. Yeah, how to push the bureaucratic reform in the local governments. The situation in national governments, in central government, is getting improved, I think. But our next challenge is how we reform the bureaucracy in the local governments. Yeah, in Kabupaten Kota, you know that Indonesia is very big. We have more than 500 kabupaten kota, with various problem and condition in the local context. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always like to ask this question: who's getting it right? Are there any governments out there or localities that you think might be a model?
Okay. Yeah, I think for local government, we have several model of good or best practices in the local government. Yeah, like Banyuwangi, and then Surabaya, for example, Kota Denpasar, Denpasar City, and I think others municipality. Yeah, they show very good improvement in the quality of permit services and so on, but the problem of reform in the public service innovation in the local government is sustainability. I observed the public service innovation since 2004. They depend really on the leadership, on the bupati and wali kota. So if the bupati wali kota falling down or not in the in the power anymore, so the people always ask whether this public service administration can also be sustainable in the new era of bupati and wali kota. So it's depend absolutely from the quality, from the commitment of local leaders in the kabupaten kota and also in the provinsi.
Okay. Paeko, some of the latest news is that Parliament initiated the revision of that 2014 state civil service law that you mentioned, and the president has approved deliberations allowing them to proceed. And the focus is CASEN, the National Civil Service Commission. What is it that parties are aiming to do, do you think?
Yeah, you know, KASN is the guardian of merit system. Yeah, so the institution that control the merit system implementation in the ministries and also in the local governments. So in the promotion system, in the code of behavior, code of ethics of the civil service system. So the political leader, especially in the local level, they don't want to be observed and controlled by the KASN, yeah, because normally, so maybe I have to explain you the history behind the law number, law 2014, yeah, about the civil service system. Because at that time, you know, the politicizations of bureaucracy, the interference of bureaucracy by the politics is, at that time was very high. So the bureaucracy is unstable, yeah, was unstable and also co-opted by the political interest, yeah, by the local leaders, yeah. And the quality of performance, quality of public services of the bureaucracy was very low because of the instability of politicization of bureaucracy. So that's why the undang-undang, the civil service law, was coming from the DPR, from Komisi Dua. Yeah, mm-hmm. From Pak Hakam Naja, Ganjar Pranowo, yeah, from Basuki Cahaya Purnama, from Agun Gunanjar at that time, they were very concerned on the quality of bureaucracy that co-opted or politicized by the political interest. So that's why we established Komisi Aparatur Sipil Negara (KASN) to monitoring, evaluation, to control the process of recruitment, selection, and also promotion to the senior executive services in the bureaucracy. And this is very much not in concordance with the political interest, yeah, for the from political leaders. So that's why I think this is. The goal is clear that they want to abolish KASN because they don't want control by appointing civil service in the higher position in the bureaucracy.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have a feel for the stance of the Widodo administration and some of the key ministers on whether they would approve such a move as this bill undergoes deliberations?
I read some notes and comment from the Ministry of Administrative Reform, yeah, Pak Cahyo Kumolo, when when they had a meeting with Komisi Dua Parliament. So the position of Ministry of Administrative Reform as representative of the President is very clear. They reject the plan of abolishing of the KASN, yeah. And I think, yeah, the minister will also maybe strengthen the power and also the authority of KASN in controlling the bureaucracy, yeah, for merit system. So this is clear, the position of the government.
Yeah, so the position of the government and Pak Cahyo Kumolo would be to turn this initiative on its head and make it something, you know, to strengthen bureaucratic reform.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that going to work?
I talked to the Pak Doli Kurnia, the chairman of Komisi 2 in the DPR. So he is very supportive to KASN. So he said that he will fight for negotiating in the process of legislative drafting, a discussion in the parliament, to support the KASN as the guardian of merit system. Okay. So I talked personally to Pak Doli Kurnia as chairman of Commission 2, yeah.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. One of the criticisms of KASN is not really a criticism of KASN, but rather of the current structure of institutions, because there's the Ministry of Empowering the State Apparatus and Bureaucratic Reform on one hand. There's also National Civil Servants Agency, the BPK, and then the State Administrative Institute, LIN. So can you, is there scope for condensing or consolidating these?
Pak Jeb and Pak Steve, I think we regulate distribution of authority amongst these four agencies. Yeah, so I think it is clear that MENPAN or Ministry of Administrative Reform is responsible for making the law and regulations about the civil service. LAN is responsible for training, education, and also research for civil service system in Indonesia. BKN is responsible for administrating the or managing the civil service, and KSN is responsible for controlling, evaluating, monitoring of merit system in Indonesia. So I was also involved in the drafting the distribution of authority amongst these ministries. So we make sure that there is no overlapping authority among these ministries, Pak Jeb and Pak Steve.
Okay. All right, okay. Well, and then just one other question I had is, it's been difficult at times in the past for civil servants to undergo dismissal in cases when they've done something egregiously wrong, and the minister, for example, would like to dismiss them. But I think their job security has been very strong. Is that a particular problem? And if so, is that still problematic, or is that something that's changing also?
This is still problematic, especially in the local governments. I think, as I mentioned before, that civil servants is much depend on the political leaders. Yeah, so that's why the KSN is very important to avoid the politicizations of political interest into the bureaucracy. They are very dependent dependent on the order of the political party or political actors and so on. So that's why actually I proposed at the time to protect the civil servant from having dissenting opinions, for example, against the order of the Bupati, Wali Kota, and also Governor or the ministers. But at the time, so some senior executive services in the national level rejected my proposal. Yeah, so because they thought that this idea against the loyalty of civil servant to the superiority. This is the problem. But if you ask, this is still the problem. Yes. I think this is one of the problem, how to make independent, impartial, and also neutrality of the civil servant from the political interest. Yeah.
But I want to jump in here with a question. It might actually be the last one. I don't know. But do you have a sense of how Indonesia is doing relative to peers in the region with respect to bureaucratic reform? And I ask this because, you know, Indonesia has its problems, but it's not as if places like Thailand and Malaysia are squeaky clean. I mean, how is Indonesia doing with respect to cleaning up governance or bureaucracy? And is there a line that you can draw between transparency in government and attracting FDI and improving the standard of living? You know, places like Thailand, not exactly corruption free, and yet they haul in as a per capita much more FDI than Indonesia.
That good question, Pak. I think the bureaucratic reform is not independent from the political reform. Yeah, I think the quality of the bureaucracy, for example, foreign direct investment, is depend also on the quality of a political system in Indonesia. So I think if we have to improve the quality of bureaucracy, we have also to reform the quality of political process, like how the elections of local leaders, for example. Yeah, Indonesia is not a centralized state. Yeah, most of the authority have been also decentralized to Bupati and Wali Kota, pemerintah daerah kabupaten kota. Yeah, so that's why the quality of public services in Indonesia not only depend on Jakarta, but only on the more than 534 bupati, wali kota, and bupati in Indonesia. Yeah. So this is the problem. Even we tried hard to reform the bureaucracy, if the political system still remain the same, it is very difficult to improve the quality of bureaucracy because, as I mentioned before, the problem of Indonesian bureaucracy is the inequality position between the politic and also the bureaucracy. So the bureaucracy is always under the political interest. So that's why I think maybe you can see the corruption done by the Ministry of Social. Yeah, this is I think the politician and so on. So the symbiosis mutualism between the politic and also the bureaucracy is the most problem in Indonesia to create more competitive foreign direct investment and so on. So I think improving in the political system will influence also the quality of bureaucracy in Indonesia.
Forum comes from the top.
Yeah, my last question to move from the top to the bottom. I was curious about the recruitment process. How has that changed over time?
Oh yeah, this is one of the most important reform in Indonesia because we introduced computer assisted tests, yeah, to avoid corruption, collusion, and also nepotism in the selection process of civil service system. And I think this is a very big impact on the bureaucracy. Yeah, so we can select and we can choose the best graduate from the university through the very open and also competitive process. Yeah, through the computer assisted test. Yeah, I think this is one of the what we call some of the fundamental reform that we did in the bureaucratic reform in Indonesia. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Yeah, that sounds promising. Yeah, and you head the independent team on national bureaucratic reform under the vice president, Maruf Amin. How is that going lately?
I think we have a very good communication and also relations, yeah, in advising bureaucratic reform program in Indonesia. So we just had a meeting two weeks ago, yeah. And we evaluate the problem that we're facing in the bureaucracy. Yeah? For example, the launching of Transparency International Indonesia, that the index, perception index corruption in Indonesia is lower than last year's. Yeah, or we can improve the corruption perception index. And the President Jokowi has also criticized that the bureaucracy is very slow to manage COVID-19 and so on. So I propose some fundamental reform, how to make alignment among the ministries in the planning and budgeting so that they can have a share impact, share outcome in doing development program. Yeah, this is one of the problem in Indonesia. Yeah, silo mentality, sectoral, yeah, is very high, and that's why we are proposing so-called SAKP, System Akuntabilitas Kinerja in Pemerintah. We have already SAKIP, but SAKIP is only one in the ministries and also in the national agencies. But now we are going to make alignment among the ministries for priority program like poverty alleviation, for example, yeah, for social protection and so on. So how we get together among the ministries, determine the performance indicator and have share outcome and share impact among the ministries related.
Did that CPI result cause some upset with the president and the vice president? The Transparency International finding that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. This is also one of the point that we discussed with the vice president 2 weeks ago. How to improve the CPI, yeah, perception perception index in the next years, yeah.
Wow. It sounds like you have a lot of work to do, so we should let you get back to it, Paiko.
Oh, yeah. There is a lot of job to do in the bureaucratic reform.
Yeah. We're very appreciative of your time. Is there anything else that we should know that we didn't ask you about?
Yeah, I think bureaucratic reform depends on the political commitment, yeah, collective leadership from the president, vice president, also the ministers, yeah, the cabinet, and also the support from governor and also Bupati and Wali Kota. So I believe that Indonesia will improve the bureaucracy, and this is one of the key important variable to be, I think, the developed country, yeah, as predicted by the McKinsey Institute. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's an interesting time for this discussion, and there's some promising initiatives underway, and we'll watch it very closely. And thank you for doing all the work that you do.
And that's the program. Here at Reformasi Dispatch, Stephen Handoko is our producer and editor. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. For a free trial of Kevin O'Rourke's Reformasi weekly newsletter, easily the best roundup of news and policy you're going to get out of Indonesia, go to reformasi.info. This podcast is a proud production of On the Level Media. I'm Jeff Hutton. Bye for now.